You're listening to the In the Money Players Podcast. Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you in the Brooklyn bunker. Very cold in Brooklyn today, snowing even on my little run outside. It is show number 8. It is Friday, January 18th, 2019, and joined by a very special guest we'll get to in a minute, but also by the usual co-host of this radio program. He is the people's champion. He is sitting on the side of a road, I think, somewhere in the planet Texas at this point. Jonathan Kinchin. What's up, JK?
I'm outside of a hotel. I don't even know what it's called. Wingate by Wyndham. I was going to one of my favorite moves is to sneak into business centers and record my various media obligations when usually people don't know where you're at. You just get into like a business center and you just act like you're staying at the hotel. But this one was like kind of weird. It was tucked in behind. It just felt like a Keelan Green coat was going to come up behind me at any moment and tell me I had to leave. So I panicked and went out to the car.
That's pretty funny. The king of all media, you've been described by our friend Mike Maloney with your various media appearances, as you say. And now I'd like to welcome to the pod, I don't think he was ever an official guest on the other old podcast. Very happy to have him among the first guests on this one. You know him for a lot of different reasons. He's a rock star on Twitter. We'll talk about that. He is the creator of the eponymous Beamy Awards. He's also the host of the Bet America Radio Network, that's Barn Podcast. Jason Beam, welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you guys. And I got to say, I have done what Jonathan's done. I have totally done the business center move. And I've done the beauty of podcasts is you can kind of do it everywhere, right? And whenever you want. And I have a mobile mic set up. And I remember interviewing Gabby Gaudette from the snowbanked parking lot of the Mount Shasta Burger King once. So I know what Jonathan's going through right now. I've been there.
Back in the day, I was known on occasion when it was alternate side of the street parking day here in Brooklyn to sit in the Key Food parking lot. But I think you've got me beat.
No, I mean, yeah, my two best ones were I interviewed Gabby at the Burger King in a snowstorm, and then Steve Asmussen, his people, I had, you know, made a request to interview him, and they said, we don't know when. And so I said, okay, we'll just, you know, so as long as I got 10 minutes notice. So she messages me, hey, call Steve in 10 minutes. And I'm like 30 minutes from my house. It was 90 degrees outside, and I had all my stuff, and I was right next to like a really busy road. So I had to close all the windows and do the interview, and it had to have been 120 degrees the car. And if you listen, while Steve is doing, while he's talking about Snapper Sinclair winning at Kentucky Downs, you can hear me grabbing ice from my cup and pouring it on my neck.
Phenomenal. Where do you think is the weirdest place, JK, you've ever done the show from?
Bed, for sure. I mean, bed is like probably 45% of the time I've done that before. No, not that many times, but I've done bed before. I've done Vegas Hotel. I'm trying to think the craziest place I've done it. We tried to do it once from poolside in Mexico. I tried that. That didn't work.
Yeah, we had to cancel that show.
Canceling that one.
I'm going with the phone booth at the Langham for me. That's my most ridiculous place. Jason, you were telling a story right as we went on air, a Kentucky Derby legendary announcer tale. Why don't you pick that one up for the listeners?
Well, we were talking about the fairgrounds races coming up Saturday, and you were saying, God, what race number was it? Make sure I got the right race number. The great Luke Kreiboss, who was the voice of Churchill from, I think, 2000 to 2008 when he passed away, he used to tell me, he goes, the last thing I do, he goes, the minute I see number 19 go in the gate and I see number 20 is coming up, he goes, I always look down at my program just to make sure I got the right race going on. And it always just kind of made me laugh because, I mean, you know, how could you not have the right race at that point? But he the other funny thing Luke used to have, the Churchill booths at that new, since they did the addition, it's just a sheet of glass, like from head to toe. And Luke used to have the name of the starter carved into the glass. And I'm totally forgetting the guy. I remember one of them was Roger Nagel. and they changed to another starter. So he had to scratch that out in the glass and wrote it. And he used to tell me, he goes, I don't like the new starter as much. And I said, why? Is he doing a bad job? He goes, no, it was just so fun to always go Roger Nagel with the start.
That's great.
I've been lucky enough to hang out in some announcers' booths, and right before they call a race, I'm always amazed by like how distracted they can be prior and still do their job. Are you one of those guys that when you're calling, is it quiet in there for the first 15 minutes, or can you kind of memorize and kind of communicate with your guests or friends while you're doing it?
It kind of depends. Part of it depends on where the meet you are. Like if you're at Portland Meadows and it's a 6-month meet and it's the last month of the meet and you've called these horses 7 times already this season, I mean, I can memorize them in 4 seconds because you know those horses, you know those silks, and you know what's going on. Like when I was at Gulfstream West about 2 months ago filling in, and Gulfstream, I mean, they throw 11 and 12 horse fields at you. Like, I mean, you're just getting them fired at you every second. And I didn't know those horses or those silks at all. And so, I mean, that was I used every ounce of those 25 minutes I had plus the 7 minutes of drag. I actually, it was funny. I told somebody, I said, I'll be honest with you, that post time drag, it goes way faster when you're sitting there memorizing 12 horses on the grass.
That's terrific. I wanted to ask you about your recent experience behind the mic. How did you enjoy it? What did that feel like?
It was great. It was, I hadn't called a race since, I think my last race I called was March of 2015 at Louisiana Downs. And so I kind of had thought I was done with that portion of my life. And so when Peter called me about it, I was really excited. And I was like, yeah, that'd be awesome, man. I'd applied for a few. My deal with Bet America has always been that if I wanted to go call races, I could do the show in addition to it. And we'd figure it all out. And I had applied for a few other ones and really just never got a sniff. And I think things kind of fell apart at Louisiana Downs for me personally. And so I think that, my reputation maybe was like, maybe this guy's not the most reliable dude. And so I wasn't getting a sniff on jobs where I kind of thought I should have been a contender for him. So I really had kind of given up on that. And Pete reached out, and Pete, he's such a sweet guy. And he told me, he goes, I really, when I was thinking of who would fill in, he goes, I just thought, who would appreciate this the most? And he goes, I really thought you would. And I said, you're right. And it was great. Like the first day I went there, and I was really nervous. The first race, you could certainly hear my voice. I was nervous. And then I settled in, and it kind of got to be like it was, like it used to be. And it was really fun. And, when I finished the day, I was really emotional. I called my mom, and I broke down crying. I was so happy that I had kind of overcome what was a little bit of a fear because of the way things ended at Louisiana Downs. And it was just really fun. And so those whole 2 weeks it was really a blast. It was a great challenge because I don't know if you guys have seen the setup they have there.
Yes.
They knocked over the Calder grandstand. It's gone. And so they have 3 construction trailers stacked on top of each other. And that's where the stewards, the placing judges, the camera guy. So on top, it's just me and the camera guy. And you're only about 15 feet in the air, 20 feet in the air, and you're at a terrible low angle. The hedges have kind of grown up over the rail, so on both turns, you can't see the saddle towels. Mm. And I know a lot of announcers are like, oh, you never look at the saddle. Yeah, BS. if you got another identifier that you can use, you use it. So I always get annoyed when guys, I never look at saddle. Yeah, you do. And so, because when they were on the turn, if they're stacked 2 or 3 across, you're so low that you can't see those outside horses. So it was a really, really great challenge, but it was really a rewarding thing. And I'd never been to Florida, so it was fun to see a new part of the country and got to see the Pegasus statue and all that kind of fun stuff.
Very cool.
I was listening to your show earlier this week with the champ, Michael Bachok, friend of our podcast as well.
Yeah.
You're back in the booth this weekend, right? Where at?
Yeah, I'm going to Century Downs in Calgary. I'm actually good friends with some of the guys that run that operation because they were based at Hastings, and I live in Seattle, and Hastings is real close, so I've known those guys over the years. And they needed someone to fill in for a day, and I said, you know what? I said, I'm not that far away. I'll go up to Calgary, so I'm going to go there. And then they have a new track that they're actually opening in April, so I'm going to go check out that in Edmonton called Century Mile, and it's replacing the old Northlands Park, which I think the facility there just had kind of gotten outdated, and they wanted to build a new one. So it'll be a fun trip, because, so, I mean, you know, taking a vacation to Alberta in January is what a lot of people do. So, but I've called one harness race in my life, and it was at Pompano Park, and so it'll be kind of fun to try something new. I mean, I don't know a lot about harness, so I told them, I said, you're going to get some pretty bare bones race calls, but it'll be fun.
Challenging yourself personally and professionally leads to a more enriching experience of life. I like it a lot. I wasn't planning on asking about this, but I want to now. I'm a person who's certainly of the mind that when you have personal issues, whether they have to do with depression or anxiety, it's really no different in my mind than somebody who gets sick with a physical ailment. You overcome it. You move on. There's no reason to judge somebody for having had any type of issue like that in the past. I was just curious if you have any advice for people out there in the world who may have gone through something similar to what happened to you, the incident you referred to back at Louisiana Downs, in terms of your ability to turn the page and move on with your life. How did you do that, and what kind of place are you in emotionally now?
That was the turning the page was actually one of the really tougher parts. I mean, the Louisiana Downs thing, it was kind of half struggling with mental health, half my dream job at Emerald Downs opened up and they wanted me to apply. And so I went back and applied and interviewed and then didn't get it. And so I just was like, I just don't want to go back to Louisiana. And so it was a lot of different reasons. But I had struggled with the anxiety and depression stuff for a long time. I mean, even at Portland Meadows, there was one year at Portland, I think it was 2013. I'd gotten so agoraphobic, like I wasn't leaving my apartment other than to get food and go to work. And like just going up to the booth was giving me panic attacks. And so they set up a situation where I could be in my office downstairs, which was like right next to my car. And I just called the races off the TV for like half the season. And if you listen to those calls, you really can't tell that there's anything different, except for there was one race where the cameraman, the camera slipped out off of the little wheel.
And oh dear.
So they're going around the turn and the camera goes from, you know, from on the, covering the race to like literally just looking straight down at the ground for 5 seconds. And we talked about Luke Kreitboss. I used an old Luke Kreitboss trick because it was on the turn. And so I went winding around the fire turn. you learn how to stall sometimes in that, but it was, the anxiety stuff. It was just debilitating in a lot of ways. And what I found was that my life was just getting smaller and smaller because I was avoiding more and more things that I was nervous about. And then, you know, you start finding a lot of shame because of how you're living. And then you just don't want to be seen anymore. And I just really, I mean, my first year or so here at Bet America, it was this relief that I could work from home, but in a way it kind of enabled me to kind of keep avoiding seeing people. And it just kind of kept getting worse and worse and worse. And I didn't really have a moment where I was like, I need to turn this around. I honestly just started walking more and doing more stuff. And as I got my fitness back up and I kind of just started, because exposure therapy, that's the only way you get over anxiety stuff, right? Or agoraphobia stuff. And so I just started going and doing more things. And as I did more things, it became easier to do more things. And I kind of started getting that spirit to want to go to do more things. And so as far as, you know, turning the page, it took me a while to accept that because I really viewed myself just as a total failure. Cause I think that I had great potential as a race caller and I was kind of working my way up the ladder as you do. And it just kind of all blew up. And so for a long time I was like, you know, well, I blew my skills and my opportunity and now it's all over. And as you said, you come to find out that if you people know that I'd never had any ill intentions or, you know, I was like, none of my employers would ever, I've never been fired from a job and they've all told me, you know, they all liked me as an employee. And so I think people understand. It took me a while to understand that, though, because I had just so much shame about it. And, you know, as you work through it, and I've, you know, the last year or two, I've kind of found myself doing better and being in a better place. And so it's strange to kind of look back at that time, because it sometimes, like, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous or Gamblers Anonymous, it's sometimes good to keep the bad memories fresh just to remember why you want to keep working to not go back there.
At what point in your career in racing did you come up with the brilliant idea of the Beamy Awards, which is an award show that you started? And tell us a little bit about what the awards is and where in your career you kind of got the idea and the history behind it.
I was the first one was December of 2014, and I didn't promote it. It was not going to be a big thing. It was literally like a Friday night. I thought it would be funny to do like Twitter awards, and obviously all my friends are in racing, so they were all kind of racing related, and it was like, you know, best fight, and it was you know, just like, I remember the first year one of the winners was the like best moment of the year, and the winner was anytime a good horse beats a weak field off a layoff and people freak out. Like that was the and it, the Normandy Invasion, was that the horse's name?
There was a horse called Normandy Invasion. Chad Brown ran in the Derby.
Yeah, I think he was what kind of spawned that, because he had come back and he had won a 5-horse allowance at Gulfstream by 10, and people just thought, well, here's, you know, the second coming of man award. It was like he beat nope, you know, but people do that, like these horses, they come back off a layoff and they beat up on a crappy field. Gunavera did it. Remember when he won earlier this year? He beat up on a bunch of tin cans, and everybody's like, oh, he's gonna be in the Pegasus World Cup. It's like, oh, come on, he's gonna run down Accelerate. So which, by the way, he almost of course did last. But so it was just a lot of like dumb stuff like that, and it really, people liked it and they thought it was funny. And so the next year I kind of did it up a little bit more, and we started adding in the red carpet and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, we got sponsors this year. Little Red Feather Racing is our title sponsor now. And so that's kind of fun. And yeah, I mean, it's just, it's really just meant to be kind of a fun night where we can all goof around. And I very much try to make sure there's very, very little malice. There's a little poking of the bears once in a while, but I really don't, you know, I don't try to crap on anybody. And the funny thing about the first year was, we talked about Louisiana Downs. I had accepted the job at Louisiana Downs about a week before the Beamies, and I had already planned them a little bit. But I remember thinking, I go, God, should I even do this? These guys just hired me. It's, you know, it's a Caesars corporate track. Maybe I shouldn't, you know, be out here posting Photoshops of, you know, Bob Baffert or something and then going over there. And so I almost didn't do them. And then, luckily, and funny enough, the Beamy Awards have stuck and Louisiana Downs didn't.
That's pretty funny. This is the fifth annual Beamy Awards. It's coming up this weekend.
Tonight.
It's tonight. Let's give us the lowdown on where folks who want to follow along, what's the best way to do it?
Penelope Miller, who you guys probably know from America's Best Racing.
Quite well.
She one time told me her method of watching the Beamies, and I thought it was brilliant. She opens up three tabs. She has my account on one of the tabs. She has the hashtag Beamy Awards on one of the tabs, and then she has her own feed on one of the tabs. And she goes, that's how I do it every year. And I go, that makes perfect sense. But my Twitter account's at Beamy Awards, and like I said, it's all on Twitter. And there's a couple of videos. We do kind of a mock in memoriam thing and a good night thing. But yeah, if you just go to my Twitter at Beamy Awards, and you can follow along. And I always tell people, I have no. If you want to just follow tonight and unfollow, I won't message you. Would be like, hey, what's with the unfollow, man? Like, I totally get it.
And for those now, because of when this podcast comes up, when some people listen, they might be tuning in after the awards have happened. Yep. Best way to catch the show after the fact, would you think it's just going through your feed, or is there something better?
I think going through my feed, and then just I tell everybody, anything you're responding, you know, hashtag at Beamy Awards, and that way people can just click the hashtag and, as I say, watch on demand. And also, the you know, like, we've trended nationally the last 3 years,
it's
which
phenomenal.
Just cracked me up. And so, you know, and a big part of that is because everybody hashtags all the responses and stuff. So it just, the first year, I'll never forget when it trended. It was the day Rudy Giuliani announced he was either running for president or dropped out of running for president. But there was just something so hilarious to me that the trends were Rudy Giuliani and Beamy Awards.
Terrific.
What's the award, the category that's got the most contentious this year? Which one should we tune in for? It's going to be the most exciting to see.
So the categories, I get a lot of grief from people about this. So I never, there's no nominees. I mean, I always remind, like, because I get people on Twitter, like, how do I win a Beamy Award? I go, believe me, so there is no meritocracy to winning this. Like, literally, all I want to do is make it a funny night. And so anything I think is funny that I can make into a funny award is what I'm going to use. And so there's very rarely, you know, kind of set categories and stuff like that. Let me pull up my little list here, because I don't tell anybody any of the categories. The best photo to Photoshop is one we have done the last few years, and that one always seems to get a kick out of people, because, you know, it just takes a photo that somehow came up on Twitter, and then we put the person in kind of weird situations based on how the photo looks. And so I think that one will be really, really good this year. And one of my other favorites is best Twitter hiatus, because inevitably 20 times a year, at least, probably more than that, I will see people say, I am so done with Twitter. I've taken the day off, taken the week off. I'm never coming back. And then an hour later, they're posting about something. And I remember one of my favorite ones was a guy named John Piasek, who's an aspiring race caller and works in Maryland. He won the award, and he had said, he goes, I got to get off social media for a while. It stressed me out. Da, 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 da. And then like 2 hours later, he goes, hey, how about that top pick finish over at dananimus.com? So it was the most tout thing of all time, right? Because if you're a tout, like, you have to brag about it. Like, you can't just, you know, you can't just let that 4-1 winner you gave out sit there and flutter around in the ether. You got to get it out there. So I just that always kills me when guys are like, I am done with it. And I always say Twitter is like the Hotel California. You can check out, but you can't leave.
Great stuff. The leopard can't change its spots and all that.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about your background. How did you get into racing in the first place?
My dad was a gambler, and I grew up about 3 miles from Old Long Acres Racetrack, which was this beautiful track here in suburban Seattle. And I always tell people whenever I get a chance, there's a great movie that's available for free on the Seattle channel called Miracle Strip. And if you just Google Miracle Strip Long Acres, you can watch it for free. It's like an hour and a half, and it's this great documentary of an amazing track that was from 1933 to 1992. And so me and my dad would go out there. He'd take me out there every weekend. My mom would give me $20, and so I could bet $2 each race. And my dad would take the 20 and he'd go, I'll make your bets for you. And I came to find out, because I hit an exacto one time with Captain Condo over Grandstand Game. I still remember the horses. And it paid like $50. And so I asked dad for the money, and he goes, I'll get it to you Wednesday. So I realized that he was booking my action and taking the 20. But, I grew up as a gambler, and I wanted to be a jockey. And my dad was, you know, 6'2", and my mom was 5'10". So you can guess how that turned out. Real quick aside story. I had Gary Boulanger was the top jockey there when I was a kid, and he was my favorite jockey. And I had a stuffed jockey teddy bear that I named Gary Boulanger. And so one time I was getting Gary's autograph, and I was 9 years old. I mean, maybe 10 years old. It was like 1990. And he's autographing Gary Boulanger, and I told him, I said, you know, I want to be a jockey too, Mr. Boulanger. And I was about 2 inches shorter than him, and he looks over at my dad, who's 6'2", and he goes, well, good luck, kid. sent me on my way. But no, I just, I loved the sport. I loved the gambling part of it. And I kind of got away with it or away from it when Long Acres closed, because there was a 4-year period here before Emerald Downs got opened. Where there was no local racing. And I was, you know, I was a teenager then, so I was playing baseball. And then when my dad got sick, he had skin cancer. The only thing he kind of wanted to do was, other than his treatments, was go out to the Emerald. And so I started going out with him again for most of the summer of 2001. and he passed away that summer, and I kind of just kept going, and eventually got a job at Emerald Downs in 04 as a media assistant. So I was writing like turf notes and press releases, and got to meet Robert Geller, and started practicing announcing, and off I went.
Very cool.
Awesome to hear that the dad was involved. My dad probably tried to do the same thing to me, except he would give me the money and then take it back. So, I was reading your piece you wrote about poker on your blog, and one of the things that really stuck out to me, and that I'm sure this wasn't even the most important thing, but your mom ran a poker room and you worked the surveillance. Tell us a little bit about that. It sounds like an unbelievable story.
Yeah, no, my mom was her career was kind of a great story. She started, there was a poker room here called Diamond Lil's, and it was about 2 miles from Old Long Acres, and so it was, you know, there was a huge crossover of poker and horse players in the 80s and 90s, and she was a waitress there at Diamond Lil's, and eventually worked her way into accounting, and then it worked her way into being a general manager, and then she left for a couple years and their business was suffering. And so a guy named Fred, he asked her to come back and work for her, and, you know, offered her raise stuff. And she said, well, I want to be part owner. And so she bought in for 10%, and then Fred passed away a few years later. And so she bought the rest of it. And so she literally went from waitress to owner over the course of about 10 years. And she ran it for 20 years and before she sold it a couple years ago. But yeah, it was great because, you know, having a business owned by a family member, you know, when I was in college, I could kind of come and go, and she would find me a few hours every week to do stuff. And for a couple summers, I did surveillance at the poker room. And, you know, it's literally like you see in Vegas, like there's 30 TVs in front of you, and you got your little joystick where you can zoom in on stuff. And it was great as far as learning poker, because I could sit and watch the poker hands and zoom in on them. And this was
great.
2000, 2001, 2002. So this is right when that boom is happening, you know, the moneymaker and all that stuff. And so it was an amazing summer job. And, you know, it would get boring if you didn't kind of get the poker, because otherwise you're just sitting there and watching hands. And there's a lot of just procedural stuff doing surveillance. Like you got to change the tapes every 4 hours, and you got to follow around the money when they're pulling all the cash out of the tables and all that kind of stuff. But other than that, I mean, there's just a lot of downtime keeping an eye on the room. And so, and there would be crazy stuff too. I mean, there was some fights, and there was one time one guy passed away at the table, and but it's kind of a crazy, great story. I mean, as great of a story as a guy dying can be. He was like 96. He was a really older guy. And he won a pot, and he dragged the pot in, and he was stacking his chips. And he just finished stacking the chips, and like 4 minutes later, he kind of nodded off there, and he just passed away. It was crazy.
Well, if you got to go out, like, I guess you want to go out with the big stack of chips in front of you, right?
So, and the reason I say it was a great story was because his daughter played there a lot too. And I talked with her about it, and she was telling me, she goes, you know, he knew he was kind of sick and this and that. And she goes, I thought it was the perfect way for him to go. And so, you know, like I said, it's not a great thing to get that, but she knew he had a wonderful long life, and he died doing what he liked, and he won his last bet.
That's a great point. I mean, what do you think, JK? If you got to check out at the track, don't you want to do it with the winning pick six ticket in your pocket?
Man, you can give me the winning show bet. If I'm going to go, I just got to go out a winner.
Jason, I want to talk a little bit more about the poker piece. We had a very popular interview earlier in the week with Dave Gutfreund, the new NHC Tour champion. And understandably, he was a little cagey is too strong, but not particularly forthcoming when it comes to the strategies he's learned in the poker world that he has used effectively in the world of horse racing tournaments. But the one hint that he did give to folks looking to learn from what he's done this year on the tour was to send people towards that blog. What do you think people can pick up about horse racing contests from the poker world?
Well, first of all, shout out Maven. Thanks for the plug. the piece that I wrote, it kind of germinated from, there was some friends who were talking about a sequence, and somebody just said, "Oh, good ticket." And then another guy came in and said, "It's kind of a terrible ticket." And then they kind of went off and started going at each other. And I was just thinking about, because in poker, I've noticed that there is a lot more discussion about dissecting betting decisions. And I gave a bunch of examples on the blog. I mean, there's YouTube videos, there's forums, there's vlogs, there's Facebook pages. Like, there's this one called the Hand History Lounge, where you literally join this Facebook group, and every night guys just go post hands, and they discuss, you know, did I play this right? How could I have played it different? How could I have maybe got more money? And they just kind of sit and constantly talk about it.
We need more
of
that.
And what I realized was, that there's not a lot of that public discourse in racing. I do think some groups of friends talk about that. I think 95% of our conversations are about the handicapping piece, which is obviously an important part of the puzzle. But I think there's very little talked about the betting piece. And it was interesting, because I after I wrote it, I got a message from a guy who told me that he had talked to Jonathan, of all people, at some point. And Jonathan had said, he goes, "It boggles my mind that people will talk and study for 4 and 5 hours how to handicap the race and then put their bets together in 2 minutes. And I thought it was a great point, but Jonathan, but it also made me realize we just don't talk about it a lot. But the other thing I kind of realized is that, you know, most people, when they post their ticket on Twitter, they just want you to follow along and root for them. And I don't think Twitter is actually the best space to kind of do that, those surgical maneuvers on people's tickets. I feel like there's got to be some kind of a website or a chat room or group, you know, or whatever, where you can kind of willingly go to get help with that stuff, because I just don't think it comes across right on Twitter, you know, just kind of cold going to, you know, "Hey, I think you did this wrong." And people get really defensive about it. And it just seems in poker, people are a little more open to learning and just kind of seeking out that information. But then again, in racing, I just think it's tougher to have those conversations. Also, because in poker, you know, those odds are fixed. I mean, you know, you have an 8 out of 45 chance to hit your flush. And in racing, you know, you're kind of creating your own odds, because, you know, you're making your value line and what have you. But, you know, there used to be a ton of crossover between poker and racing. And like I said, when I go into my mom's poker room growing up, half the guys at the table had just been at the track, and half the guys at the table had the form with them while they're playing poker. And by the time I started working in the poker rooms, there was like 2 or 3 guys in the whole room that were horse players. And now I go there and there's none. And so,
wow.
And I don't think that is like one of those things like, you know, "Oh, racing doesn't do this." I just think that poker has kind of they've just kind of separated themselves a little bit, I think, in who approaches them, where it used to be kind of, you know, and obviously they were kind of the only two games in town for a long time as well. But I don't know. I feel like there should be more, because like I said, growing up, there was 40 mavens. There was not his ability, but guys who were very proficient at poker and the horses. And now I just don't know a lot of those people. And I mean, poker players should be ripe to play racing. And obviously part of the reason they're not is because the juice is so high.
Pricing. Yeah, the pricing is
really,
crazy.
Really tough. Yeah. It's such a tough game to not only beat, but, you know, I said in the blog piece, there's more pro poker players in a 1 mile radius around the Commerce Casino in LA or around the Bellagio in Vegas than there are in the whole country of horse players. I mean, really, if you think about how many guys make their living from gambling, I mean, it is not, or on the horses, it is not. And I don't even mean, you know, guys that are making $200,000, $300,000, guys that are grinding out 40 or 50 grand. There is not many of them. And because it's just really, really difficult to do. And the guys I know that do it are the guys that are, you know, churning for the rebates. And right. So, you know, their whole goal a lot of times is just to break even or not lose that much. And then the rebates put them over the top. It's really a challenge.
I love the idea of having a place online. We're still figuring out what the whole in the money brand, media presence, et cetera, is going to be. I love the vision of the blog site, InTheMoneyPodcast.com, becoming a place where people can come to talk about that stuff in a friendly, more extended way.
Yeah.
With Twitter, you got a few problems, right? You've got the limited character count, but you've also got the culture And you've got some smart people on there who like want to do nothing more than tell other people how dumb they are. And that's not a place from which you can get to the kind of community you're describing in poker. But I do think you're right that there'd be room for it to exist in perhaps another forum.
Yeah, I mean, I found when I, you know, I don't play anymore, but I found that when I have those discussions with people in person or, you know, one-on-one, that they're really, really valuable and engaging. Just, and even for me, just as someone who's wanting to improve my knowledge, you know, from a content creation standpoint and not from a personal betting standpoint. So, you know, some of the lessons I've learned from having those conversations is invaluable, and almost none of them have taken place in that public Twitter forum. They've taken place in private messages, emails, or even better, in person. And it's interesting because, like I said, in poker, those conversations are really, like, guys will come home from a session of poker and they will get right on the internet and say, guys, here's what happened. I'm in the early position. I got 7-8 of hearts. I did this. I did that. I won the pot. I really think I could have got some more value. What do you guys think? And so they're really soliciting to, here, rip me apart so I can learn more. And I just think that because it's, you know, maybe, like I said, a lot of them, like the 2+2 forum is one place that sure. people do that. I think you just need to have the right place and the right situation. And, you know, and it does help when it's people that you know and trust a little bit too, because, you know, there is some vulnerability in saying, look, I spent $100 on this ticket. It lost. I know people are going to think it's a terrible ticket. I just want to know why, or maybe what I could have done different. And I'll tell you a perfect example. A friend of mine the other day was saying how somebody asked his opinion on a sequence, and he said, oh, I wouldn't play it. And he was like, why? He goes, well, because I think there's a big favorite who is a, you know, 3-5. It's a single. And he goes, I just can't get around that horse. And so therefore, I don't want to play the sequence. And he goes, the guy said, but you know who one of the winners is. That should be a good thing. And he goes, but everybody's doing that. You know, he goes, I got to do what everybody's not doing. Yeah. that's how you know, get some differentiation. But it was just interesting to hear, you know, his thoughts on that, even, you know, just like, I just think it's really valuable to hear people's thoughts. And I don't think Twitter is necessarily the best place that those conversations are had.
Now, I know your relationship to gambling is very complicated. Obviously, you speak about it with great passion. It hasn't been a positive force in your personal life. Where are you right now with betting?
I don't, and hope to keep it that way. I never had an off button. I never had the discipline to, you know, to play only my convictions. I mean, I'd study the races. I'd go out, I'd play the first race or two. If I won, I'd start firing more. If I lost, I'd start trying to play catch up. And I remember when I stopped playing the races, I remember trying to go back to poker, and I noticed that mentality had kind of was carrying over to poker. Because when I first played poker, I was actually really disciplined at it. And so I just know for me, it's just not a good thing. And so I just avoid it, and I don't do it. And you know, I felt hypocritical before, but for working in the business and doing that, yeah. But you know, it's also I gotta eat and I gotta pay my bills, and so. But I've really become much more comfortable with the idea of, look, this is something I don't do, and you know, when I'm also very, I even wrote that in the poker blog, like, you know, who am I to go have a ticket discussion with someone when I'm not doing it? But I do think I can contribute to those conversations. And I've always looked at myself, as far as the podcast is concerned, as just wanting to create conversation and entertainment and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think there's ways to do it. And it took me a while to kind of figure out how to do it. Like my first couple of years of not betting, like 2011, 2012, 2013, I really avoided all of it. I stopped doing picks at Portland for the program. I didn't bring cash to the track. I didn't, you know, I didn't walk around the gaming area at all. I mean, I went up through the back elevator. I mean, I really took every precaution to just avoid it. And I kind of started dipping a toe into just talking about it more and doing all that kind of stuff, because I just thought that I kind of needed to, as far as, you know, to put out an engaging product. And so it's a little bit of a walk in the line, but you know, we deal with it.
You've dealt with it well, and you do still handicap, which I think is interesting. And I was curious to just ask you a little bit about your handicapping process, especially with betting removed from the equation. How do you approach looking at the races, for example, that we're going to be talking about in a couple of minutes at Fairgrounds this weekend?
I mean, I will still very much approach. Well, here's the thing. So my thoughts on betting or how I would bet have changed about 100 or what's it, is it 180 degrees? That's turning all the way around, not 360. I look at it totally different now. A lot of that's just from what I've learned from other friends and stuff. That being said, I don't want to ever try that because, like I said, I know how that, I've played that whole thing out, man. I know how it goes. So, but I definitely look at things way, way different. I mean, I was very much raised from the TVG model of I'm going to play pick fours, pick fives, and I got to put every horse in there that I think can win within my budget and really not taking into account proper ticket structure, overlays, any of that kind of stuff. It was like, I'm going to pick, I think A, B, and C are who can win the most, so I'm going to put A, B, and C on there, even if they're 3-5, 6-5, and 2-1. And I think that was not helpful as far as my gambling career, but honestly, it wouldn't have mattered. Like I said, I just don't have the off button. I don't have the discipline to do it. But I do definitely try to find myself now looking through the races and kind of seeing how what I think is the most efficient way to map it out, you know, how I think other people are going to play it. That's one thing I never used to do is spend time thinking about how my competition is going to play a sequence. You know, that example I gave you of the guy the other day, you know, if everybody's singling the 3-5 shot, how am I going to make my ticket different so that if it hits, I'm rewarded with more money? Because, you know, if I see guys all the time, like, 8-1 to start the sequence. It's like, yeah, but that was the leg that everybody was going to be 5 or 6 deep. You were 5 or 6 deep to get it. So now, you know, your equity going forward is the same as everybody else. Whereas if you single that horse, now you open up the rest of the sequence. Or if, you know, I mean, there's a lot different ways I think about it now than I used to.
Just before we get into the nuts and bolts of handicapping, what are you looking at data-wise these days?
I'm a Briz guy. I'm a company man.
Good man.
No, I mean, it's funny. I like the optics program. I don't subscribe to it because, you know, just spending money to have the data and not play it is a little bit silly. But when I have come across it and I'm friendly with Emily and John Doyle who work there, I do think it's a really valuable tool, particularly for pace and trip notes. And so when I come across that, I like to use it. I still look at DRF some, but Briz is kind of my main thing. And I've gotten to where I watch for the circuits that I really follow. I actually watch quite a bit of replays, and a lot of that is just for the show because you kind of got to know what's going on. But a lot of it's, you know, trip handicapping and just making notes for horses. Because, you know, I'll mention horses I like on the show, and you know, everybody on the show knows I'm not betting them, but I still think sometimes there's horses worth betting. I mean, there's the stakes at Aqueduct on Saturday, Toboggan, that horse on the rail had like the most brutal trip of all time last weekend. But once the horse got through, it didn't really accelerate like you kind of thought it was. And I was saying on the show, I go, I think people are going to bet this horse because the trouble was huge. And it probably did make a difference in the finish, but I said, I didn't see that horse necessarily take off like a rocket once it got freed. Those, you know, and Syndergaard's not exactly the world's, you know, biggest, you know, heart-filled horse. So I think a lot of people are going to bet that horse off the trip, and I think maybe it's one to kind of stay away from.
Let's talk about these races at Fairgrounds. We're going to look at 4 races. We'll start off with the 9th, this Louisiana Stakes, 1 1/16 on the dirt. Jason, as our guest, we'll have you start off before we bring in JK for his thoughts.
Well, what I think is so interesting about this race is your morning line favorite is a horse who has not finished the course in 2 of the last 5 races. And if you go back, a 6th race was 6th beaten 19. So essentially eased. And that's Honorable Duty, who's on the outside. Now, the other 3 races are decent. There's a win for Optional 100 and then a second, a third at grade 1 and grade 3 level. But it seems like, you know, there are some big question marks on this horse But, you know, and some of the finishes, those are in tough races. But I don't know, taking a short price on a horse that has big question marks to me is always a no-go. Now, the horse loves the fairgrounds, is 3 for 3, and, you know, that's certainly something to think about. But again, to me, when it comes to favorites, particularly ones that might be solid favorites, I'm immediately looking for question marks to avoid the horse and not reasons to go for it. So I thought it was interesting in the sense that there's a favorite in this race that I don't like, which to some degree to me means I don't necessarily have to be right with one horse, because if I'm, you know, I can pick two or three, because now I'm getting prices on all three of them.
Makes perfect sense. And if I put your feet to the fire and made you make a selection of one of those three that you like the best, who would you come up with?
I kind of like the Brad Cox horse a little bit. Pioneer Spirit was finished third last time, but Brad Cox horses, you know, they run, and the horse had just gotten to the fairgrounds for the first time in that race, and the Tenacious. And so I don't know. I just thought the horse was worthy of some improvement. Brett Calhoun is really, really cold down there this meet. I wanted to like Silver Dust, who's coming in off a couple of wins. But Calhoun's barn's kind of chilly. And so I ended up, if I had a top pick, quote unquote, it would probably be the 4. And then the 3 Fat Man was kind of my other one.
Makes sense. And I like the way you approach it in terms of sometimes your opinion of the race is more to be anti the favorite than for the selection. Because it's a podcast, we force you to make a selection, basically so we can claim it if you win. Enlightened self-interest here. But I got
a red board alert on my show. Anytime I red board, I play the red board alert.
I think we need that around here. JK, how do you see it?
Man, I actually love the horse that Jason doesn't like, an Honorable Duty. You know, he had mentioned back in 2017, the horse had some races where he was eased, came back and still ran really well. You know, I actually bet him that day in the marathon, in the Breeders' Cup. I was alive to him for a lot of money in the Breeders' Cup betting challenge. I thought that he would be forwardly placed going that, whatever it is, 14 furlongs. And he just, that race was not for him. And he just absolutely stopped. He was vanned off that day, obviously. I think it was the distance that caused the problem. The fact that he shows up back here in this spot tells me that he's probably, you know, he's probably okay. Brendan Walsh is not one of the trainers that we kind of put in the delinquent category of some of the trainers that we have where we think they're up to no good. I think Brendan Walsh would do right by this gelding if he wasn't going in the right direction. I think he'll be fine here, and I think he gallops. I love the horse in this spot. Anything multi-race-wise, I would try to single here and get out alive. Obviously, Harlan Punch for Cox makes a little bit of sense, too. Second, switching to his barn, but I like Honorable Duty.
We're developing a leitmotif on the show. It's really been for a long time. We bring in a guest who makes an excellent contrarian opinion against the favorite. JK picks it anyway.
Well, the thing is, if he's singling and if he's right, he'll be the one that's rewarded. And I mean, the horse really is an either or, right? I mean, you do have to really either kind of love him or hate him, right?
Right. And I also think that I was a little bit annoyed by the morning line, because I feel like a horse who's been kind of, you know, quote unquote, eased in his last two starts, you know, or at his last start, why is he the favorite? You know, so I'm hoping that he actually drifts a little bit. You know, I could see Harlan Punch for Brad Cox actually going off favored, or maybe, you know, someone else. You know, maybe I don't know, anyone could possibly go off favored outside of Honorable Duty. So I'm hoping he drifts. Now, if he's 4 to 5, 3 to 5, I'd probably jump on the Jason bandwagon of trying to find some value elsewhere. But I think he could be ignored just a little bit.
All right, let's move on to race 10, the Colonel Bradley. We're moving to the turf course, 1/16. JK, we'll keep it with you.
You know, looking at the last race that a lot of these are coming out of, the one that Great Wide Open won, and the pace was really slow. I was trying to find an alternative to the Great Wide Open who kind of set that easy, those easy fractions. Big Changes is one that I don't want. He was close enough that if he was good enough, he could have ran by. And the same with Sir Dudley Diggs. I mean, I think that the Great Wide Open is the most likely winner. He's tactical, he's forward, all of those things that you want to see in these turf races where a lot of times they're grabbing. If I was going to look for an alternative, one that presents a lot of value, I think the 5 Team Colors, he was actually the one that was the furthest back trying to close into those slow fractions that the Great Wide Open had last time. So in a contest format, I'd look to try to play a horse like Team Colors. When it comes to multi-race wagers, I think I'd probably try to put 60 to 75% of my money through the Great Wide Open, and then maybe spread a little bit with the remaining percentage, most of it focused on team colors. For selection purposes, I'm going to take the horse that's going to be loose on the lead in Great Wide Open, but I definitely would take team colors into consideration.
All right, interesting. I was sure you were going with team colors as your top pick there, but that's more of the tournament one because you think the pace advantage potentially too great for Great Wide Open. Jason, how do you see it?
Peter, I'm sure you guys have run into this before. Have you ever had guests on your show where they talk about a horse with such passion that you end up, they basically talk you into it?
Oh, absolutely.
That was kind of what happened to me with Michael Baychak the other day with Great Wide Open, because he was loving how good he thought that last race was. And, you know, for the horse is clearly better on the lead, right? I mean, you look at the races where he doesn't get to that lead and they don't end up very good. And the ones where he's on the lead, he runs pretty big. And I just think he holds a pretty strong advantage. The horse to the outside, the Brad Cox horse, has some speed, but it's dirt speed. You have to go back quite a ways to see what the horse's turf pace was. And interestingly enough, the other Cox runner is kind of a forwardly placed one, right? Big Changes is probably going to be the one right in behind those ones. So I'm curious what Pioneer Spirit does, because I think that affects whether or not Big Changes or somebody else comes and runs down this horse, because it seems like Great Wide Open's just one who is really relishing things right now. And is really digging on the fairgrounds. And I think the outside draw allows them to, you know, kind of see what people are going to do. But I don't think there's much scene that's going to happen. I think they're just going to go to the front and catch me if you can.
Yeah, it's interesting looking at that horse you refer to, Jason, Pioneer Spirit on the outside. I would think he'd have no choice but to go. JK, what do you think? Do you think Giroux is going to make things a little difficult for Great Wide Open there? Or do you think he's going to grab? Or do you think Great Wide Open's early pace is such that it'll just it won't even matter?
Well, I think a lot of times when you're trying to figure that out, one of the things that I like to do is look to see who the ownership groups are. You know, when Baffert has two in, it's like, well, Baffert's not going to use a Zayat horse as a rabbit for a Gary and Mary West horse like that. You can't do that. But, you know, in these situations like this, where it's the same ownership group, you would think that they would do that. I would think Pioneer Spirit would be pretty aggressive, especially from that outside post. But the way that Great Wide Open kind of shut off and kicked home in the last two, I don't see that as necessarily being an issue. If a horse can get loose in a soft paced race, then that typically tells you that they'll slow down and come into hand, and that they're rateable horses. It's the runoffs that are the ones that you got to be careful about. I think the Great Wide Open will sit right off if Pioneer Spirit goes, or Great Wide Open will go. I don't think it'll make a difference.
Gotcha. All right, let's go on to race 11, the Silver Bullet Day, one of my favorites from back in the day. She was really cool, filly. Jason, we're going to start with you on this group of three-year-old fillies. How do you see it?
Well, this has been such a good division down there over the years. It's crazy, the three-year-old fillies that have come out of. And the next race in the sequence is Rachel Alexander Stakes, and she was one of them. I didn't think that, you know, there's any world beaters in here. I'm really intrigued by the seven-horse Mandy Blue, just because of what they started her at Indiana. Broke the maiden coming from off the pace, sprinting on the dirt. And then they stretch out on the turf, and she runs a pretty big effort and wins going away for optional 50. And I always love, you know, for these younger horses, I like seeing them make that instant jump to the allowance or stakes for it. Because so we see so many big maiden winners, and then a lot of them just don't come back as they get headed or what have you. And so now the horse is going to stretch out on the dirt. It makes me think that maybe they didn't, because they started in Indiana, because they tried the turf last time, makes me wonder if this horse has just been overachieving in the afternoons. Like maybe they didn't think they had this much horse, and now they're kind of like, hey, maybe we got a good one here. Let's take a crack with it. So I'm really intrigued by that particular runner. And I don't love the Catalano horse that's the favorite. I mean, obviously, has a class advantage. Won a grade two last time out, but a lot changes, it seems like, in those couple of months between the end of two-year-old and the early three-year-old. And so I think, you know, either the rail horse or needs supervision or somebody might kind of go with that one. So I'm hoping the seven is something and might continue to go on the upswing.
Seven Mandy Blue for Jason. Also a look at number one Fun Finder. I am with you, just looking quickly through the PPs, about not particularly wanting to trust number four, Leora, or number five, Need Supervision, both listed on the lower end of the odds spectrum. Who's your selection in here, JK?
I agree with the four and the five. I mean, both of those could probably gallop, but I want to try to get cute and beat them here. The Wayne Catalano winning the Goldenrod last time. Those horses seem to always be overbet. The horses that win those two-year-old stakes, the Jockey Club and the you know, I think it's the Kentucky Jockey Club or whatever it is, and then the Goldenrod. Mandy Blue, I agree, is interesting. I won't talk about her too much. Jason covered a lot of the things about her. One thing I will say is let's not forget that Brad Cox is going to hold up a trophy for a filly that he started on the turf that's going to win three-year-old filly on the dirt and Monomoy Girl, right? So it's I wouldn't look too much into that. And I'm trying to, you know, usually I would fade a horse like this. But with Brad Cox, it's kind of making me be a little bit more forgiving. I think the one that I was interested in, and this is a horse that's not typically one that like I can gravitate towards. I'm a speed figure guy, but Fun Finder down on the rail, those even kind of runs where it feels like they're just kind of clipping 12s around there. The one turn mile at Gulfstream drew the rail here. Kenny McPeak is cagey as ever with these types of situations. Down on the inside could inherit the lead, and then they just gotta, you know, now you gotta find out which one of these newly turned three-year-old fillies wants to pass other horses, and I think she presents a bunch of value. I would spread here in a multi-race situation, probably 1, 5, 6, 7. The 1 and the 7 present the most value. I'd take the 7 though as my selection.
Okay, I was going to ask you to clarify, so I'm glad you did. The panel sees that one the same. All right, we've got a few minutes left, and we've got one more race to talk about. We're on the Triple Crown Trail now, fellas. The LeCompte Grade 3, mile and 70. And JK, we're going to start with you.
If you like a horse here, you're a liar. This race is hard. I think War of Will will end up being the favorite based on that kind of impressive run at Churchill and the slop, which was a weird race in general. I think that was closing day at Churchill when they had that mandatory pick six payout. But War of Will, I think, will probably be the favorite. I'm going to try to get away from that horse. There's two horses that have caught my attention. The first one is Tight 10. The two-year-olds that run these kind of faster numbers, I think they always translate well when they're turning into three. I think Duke Matisse said you could expect maybe 10 to 12 points of an increase based on what a horse could run when they were two. If you look at Tight 10, that could be a pretty big jump that could make this one tough to beat. Steve Asmussen doesn't need any introductions. My kind of sneaky one is the two horse down on the inside. I think it's Malpace. When the pace figure is kind of backwards like that, if you look at Timeform US where they ran really fast early sprinting, I think it just shows a lot of ability that a lot of energy was probably used early in the race that shouldn't have been. And with training, maturity, that if that energy can be harnessed and be used differently, you can kind of see those big jump ups. The horse is obviously tactical. We'll be able to save ground on the inside. I think that one's a little bit sneaky and interesting as a horse that could be forwardly placed and could show up, you know, going that two turns for the first time. I'm going to pick Tight 10 as my selection. But for the record, if you're playing any picks, I definitely would use the two as well.
I think what you're talking about projecting figure improvement, it's not like it magically happens between two or three. You've got to look at what month it happened in and then maybe be able to project a couple of points improvement for a month. But a horse who is talented enough to be running a 79 in the summer, then you take, 3 months of winter improvement. 10 to 12 sounds like a lot to expect here in the middle of January, but I mean, I think 6 or 8 feels about right.
But the other thing I think it's important, and maybe on the last show we didn't say this out loud, and trust me, I bought his book 10 times and sent it to friends about, hey, you need to learn about speed figures. But Buyer with two-year-olds, if a number comes back too fast, he will project that down. You know, the same thing he did with Bolt Doro. It's like, well, Bolt Doro, if he ran this fast, he's the fastest two-year-old ever. So I can't do that. So I'm gonna project the number down a little bit. So you got to be careful if a horse who was, earned a 65, there could be a little bit of projection in that. It could have really been a 72, 73, 74. So that's one of the reasons I think you can see the big jumps is a lot of times I think figure makers are a little bit hesitant to do that. And I think Craig Milkowski even does a little bit of it, not too much, but a little bit of it. We can ask him next time we have him on.
Absolutely. All good people to have on the show, Buyer, Duke Matisse, and Craig Milkowski. Jason, bring us home here for the LeCompte. How do you see it?
I'm similar to Jonathan's original thought in the sense that there was nobody who I was just thinking like, man, this thing's going to jog. And I love his points on Titan. Titan had like such a brutal trip in that Breeders' Cup too. I mean, I think he hit the rail and it looked like he was just massively uncomfortable in the early stages. And that obviously led to the not great late stages. The other horse coming out of the juvenile, I thought was a little bit interesting as far as Mr. Money, just because, you know, you beat 9.5 lengths and obviously there's no game winner or Nick Sko in here, we don't think. But to me, this horse, at least to the quarter pole, kind of looked like it was traveling okay with the rest of those. So I'm a little interested in Mr. Money, but I'm going Super Bomb here. I'm going to the 5, Night Ops for Keith DeSormo, a maiden. So that's certainly a big question mark. I know they've had some rain there in the last couple of days at Fairgrounds, and I know it might rain again on Saturday. I think that maybe moves this horse up. The horse that beat him, Admire, kind of had a perfect just first over, not to use a harness term. I'm in harness mode right now, but kind of had the first over trip last time. And this one came running, and I just thought ran a pretty nice race in the slop last time. The big long fairground stretch, there's a few in here that look like they're a little bit speedy, and you know, and it's newly turned 3-year-olds going 2 turns. So I thought in a race where I didn't love anybody, I think my brain tells me to go for Price, and I think this one's going to be a big one.
I like it. That's a compelling case. Jason, thank you so much for all of your insights and handicapping and also just sharing some of your story. We did not talk about your book at all. Want people to know about that as well. It's called Southbound. Where can people find it?
It's at most of your online book retailers, Barnes & Noble and Powell's, what's the big one? Amazon.
I've heard of them.
All three of that place. Peter, have you ever been to Powell's Books in Portland?
Yes, one of the best independent bookstores in the country.
In the world, right?
The world, probably. Yeah, it's a magical place. I've seen some cool readings out there, and it's a must-go-to when you're in Portland. I mean, so much great stuff in Portland.
I can tell you one of the greatest moments of my life was seeing my book on the shelf in Powell's. I remember the first time I saw that, I mean, I just was ready to lose it. And I think I brought like 5 consecutive first dates to Powell's after that and would slyly walk by that aisle.
Oh, they have my book. That's cool. How I didn't know that already. Yeah.
We just happened to be walking through the B section of literary. Yeah. Yeah. Southbound is available. And a lot of horse players have told me they enjoy it. And so, I hope they would check it out.
Good stuff. For more from Jason Beam right away, you want to check out this year's the 5th annual Beamy Awards. You can check him out at Beamy Awards on Twitter. You can also hear him on the Bet America Radio Network. Easiest way for folks to find the pod?
Same as you guys, wherever you find your podcast. But betamerica.com/barn. is a good direct link, but iTunes, Spreaker, Stitcher, iHeart, all those ways. I have noticed that it's always tended to be very Apple heavy on our downloads. So I don't know if people just love iTunes and Apple, or it seems like a lot of people listen on their phone.
It's easy.
Is that true for you guys as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of direct stuff from SoundCloud as our host. We get a lot from SoundCloud, but iTunes is most of the market for sure. And the convenience of it on there makes sense. So please subscribe. And Jason, I'd love to have you back on the show too. And if you're ever hard up for a guest, I bet JK or I could help you out.
Well, we've already talked about that. We know there will be some in the money presence on the barn shortly.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I want to thank Jason Beam one more time. I want to thank DJ Unstable for his continued technical support. But most of all, I want to thank all of you, the listeners. You make the show so much fun to do. Hey, if you haven't done our survey yet, I'm going to leave it live for a couple more days and then call it a wrap. We're getting some great information. It's helping me out tremendously. I'm going to leave a link on the next blog. I'll put it right at the top. InTheMoneyPodcast.com. Go there and you can click on the link and please take our survey. Also, if you're really feeling froggy and want to jump and help us out, go ahead and go to iTunes, leave a review, wherever you can. Subscribe to the blog, inthemoneypodcast.com. We've had a tremendous amount of support from listeners during this transitional period, and we appreciate the support again. You are the ones who make the show so fun to do. We love hanging out here with you two times a week and are going to continue to do so for the indefinite future on the In the Money Players podcast. And that's all we got. We will be back next week. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.